I've been successfully caring for plants for 3 years, but in the last 3 months that I've taken these classes, I feel like I am able to understand my plants and the care so much more deeply. And I just feel like I'm looking at nature differently, almost like truly understanding how things work. And I feel like amidst our 7-week class, you would say something and I would like interrupt the class on Zoom and be like, wait, so pruning, like the actual science behind why pruning works is because of this hormone? Like what? Because, you know, we're told so many things, especially when you're a houseplant parent and it really is a hobby. You're told so many things, you know, you're told only prune this way, water this way, bottom water this way, but you don't understand capillary action and you don't understand plant hormones and you don't understand photosynthesis. So you don't really understand why light is so important. And following whatever someone else tells you is so different than like intrinsically knowing what's right.
Yeah. And I think that plants are really diverse. So there's no hard and fast rule to being a good plant parent. Mm-hmm. Just like there's no hard and fast rule to being a good parent. You could have multiple children and you deal with them all in very different ways. And that's because plants are their own people in a sense. And learning the science actually helps you better troubleshoot, right, what you're doing and how you could do something better or change something different and not worry about actually killing your plant.
Hi, plant friends. Welcome to episode 97 of
Bloom and Grow Radio.
Hello, my plant friends. I hope you have had beautifully planty weeks. I know I have. I am loving the growing season for my outdoor and my indoor plants. All my houseplants are putting off so much growth. I mean, watching tomato flowers turn into tomato fruits, or actually, I guess, berries. They're botanically categorized, which is something I learned from today's guest, Dr. Barnes. But that's one of my favorite pastimes in the summer. So I am enjoying the abundance of growth in my life right now. And I hope you are too. I am so excited about today's episode and to welcome Dr. Elle Barnes to Bloom and Grow Radio. She is my teacher from my Intro to Plant Science course that I took virtually with the New York Botanical Garden. And holy moly, plant friends, I am bringing the nerd heat this summer to you guys. This is a nerdy one and a really fun conversation. I took Intro to Plant Science with the New York Botanical Garden virtually via Zoom during this period of social distancing. And what I learned throughout the course not only blew my mind, because as you're going to hear in our conversation, plants are so freaking cool, but the act of showing up to this class via Zoom 2 nights a week for 7 weeks with the same people really just provided me such a nice structure and a form of community that I think I really needed in this crazy time of social distancing, especially in our small apartment in New York City, which was like the hotbed of coronavirus. It was amazing. I'm so thankful to New York Botanical Garden for making all these virtual courses. And I have to say, I think Intro to Plant Science might be my favorite class I've taken so far. It's not like I want to rate them, but man, you dive into just all of the basics of all of the processes that these plant babies that we have go through in order to thrive. And there's so much to learn. And it's just so helpful. It's so helpful to understand these concepts. And what I love about Dr. Barnes, and I'm hoping that she will grace us on the podcast again, is she just does such a good job at breaking down these difficult plant science topics so that even I could understand them. And she's extremely patient, as you'll also find out in our conversation. So I was having so many aha moments in the course of this class that I actually started a running list at the bottom of my notes document called Aha Moments, so I could keep track of them because I didn't want to forget any of them. So that's what this episode is. So in today's chat, I talk with Dr. Barnes about all of my aha moments. We go through each one and Dr. Barnes explains or helps me explain whatever process we're talking about or fundamental principle that I learned. And I hope that it helps you guys learn it too. So this is like the ultimate goodie bag of all the things that I learned in Intro to Plant Science, and I hope it helps you. Just like my drainage episode that was last month, I am so overly excited in this conversation, plant friends. I think I talk a little bit more than I normally do, but it's just my enthusiasm. I just feel so lit up from all the learning that I've been able to experience. in this season of life. So, plant friends, I hope this episode brings you some aha moments on your own and helps you and your plant collection continue to bloom and grow. Please share your aha moments on Instagram and tag me because I want to know what they are. So if you're interested in virtual learning opportunities with the New York Botanical Garden in this social distancing period, I can't suggest their virtual hub enough. They have a ton of free resources like videos, plant guides, and virtual events and tours of the garden, in addition to all of their courses that they offer at their virtual hub. You can find it at nybg.org/nybg-at-home. So the virtual hub is called NYBG at Home. Also, big announcement, they are opening their doors back up in July, finally, to members only. I got to tell you, after all of this isolation, I am so excited to get back to the garden and roam the grounds and hopefully take Billy for a picnic sometime soon. So members of the Botanical Garden are going to be the first to be able to have access to the park after reopening, in addition to free admission year-round and special discounts and more. So if you're in the New York area, consider becoming a member of the New York Botanical Garden this year to increase the plantiness in your life. Gosh, we've never needed it more, have we? Special thanks to our newest Patreon Plant Friend supporters, Erin Rodriguez, Sophia Lee, Tanisha Heil, Alex Allen, and Anna Childry. Thank you. So many of you joined in the last couple of weeks. Those of you who are my current Patreon plant friend should have already gotten the survey that I sent to our Patreon community as I'm beginning to build out a very exciting new offer for our community that's going to be hosted on Patreon, and I'm using the Patreon plant friends to give me their input to build it out. And I am super excited and will report back with more info there later. But if you are interested in becoming a plant friend of Bloom and Grow Radio by supporting us monetarily on a monthly basis for as little as a cup of coffee, you can check out the link in the show notes for more information. I really hope you have all the aha moments today, my plant friends. This is such a fun conversation. Plant friends, we all know how much I adore my WallyGrow Eco Planter green wall in my apartment. I'm sure you have seen all of the pictures I'm always posting of its magic on my Instagram. But I've got exciting news for you. WallyGrow has a new product, Loop. They have taken all of the innovation and sustainability commitments from their famous eco planters that I love so much and created a gorgeous and customizable hanging planter, Loop. So plant friends, we all love the look of hanging planters. They help solve floor space issues, they add texture to a wall, and obviously they just look adorable. But I'm going to be real with you. I have a lot of hanging planters in my apartment because I have no floor space, and many of them have really been a struggle to upkeep, whether it's wrestling the plant in and out of its macrame hanger, or the strings of the hanger getting wet and moldy, or the angle that the plants hang from make watering really difficult. The Loop solves all these problems. It is the hanging planter of my dreams. Not only is it a clean design that comes in 5 gorgeous colors and many cord styles that allows you to fully customize a Loop and look for your home, but it was designed with our plants' health in mind. So it's a 2-shell system. It has the inner shell with 360 degrees of air for the best drainage and airflow possible for our plants, the key to not overwatering, the key to healthy, happy roots, and an outer shell that ensures no leakage. No leakage, plant friends. So this 2-shell system also gives you easy access to your plant without having to wrestle the entire pot out of the hanger, which is a huge thing for me. The 2-shell system is so functional and adorable, and because the Loop is so functional and adorable and eco-friendly, I think I'm actually going to start collecting them not only to use for their hanging ability, but also to just use as normal planters because they have a flat bottom and can sit on any surface, and once again, they are entirely leak-proof. So I have the white one already, which I love, and I'm planning on ordering some of their terracotta colored ones to use as planters just for some of my surfaces for my special plant babies in my grow shelf. I also love WallyGrow as a company and that their products are made from 100% recycled water bottles, plant friends, and they can be used indoors and outdoors. So WallyGrow is offering a limited time discount of 15% for Bloom and Grow listeners for Loops only. It's expiring August 4th. So to get 15% off of a Loop, Use code BLOOMANDGROW15, so BLOOMANDGROW15 for 15% off at checkout at wallygrow.com. Once again, that's 15% off using code BLOOMANDGROW15 for 15% off at wallygrow.com. Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. Okay, here's Dr. Barnes. Dr. Barnes, welcome to Bloom and Grow Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on the show today because we actually just finished Intro to Plant Science with New York Botanical Garden today. I just finished the final like an hour ago, and you have been blowing my mind in this class, and I'm so excited to be able to share your teaching style with this community because I really have learned so much from you.
Great.
So before we dive into all of the mind-blowing facts that I want to share with people, can you tell our community a little bit about how you became the doctor plant lady you are today? What has your journey been with plants?
Yeah, so I think my journey with plants started when I was younger. Both of my parents were avid gardeners. My mom is a personal bonsai expert. She had at one point 20 bonsais in our yard and then in our house during the winter.
Oh, wow.
And when I moved to college, my mom told me, I'm going to give you this violet to take care of so that you remember to take care of yourself and to take care of your plant. And about the first semester of college, I killed it. And it was horrible. And maybe that says something about, you know, my first semester in college and my experience there. But it also made me realize, wow, this is actually a lot harder than my mom made me believe for all of these years. And so I've always been fascinated by science. And I really, as a scientist and as someone who studied science in school, I thought, okay, I might not have a green thumb, but I definitely can use science to better understand what these plants are thinking and what they need. And ever since I started to view it in that sense, I've become way better at taking care of my plants. And it's also been more fun for me. So as far as getting my PhD, I actually am more of a microbial ecologist. So I work on all the microorganisms that live in, on, and around us inside of forests and in the forest soil and how that affects all the things that live in the forest. But I've always had this affinity for plants. And I love teaching at the garden because it gives me a chance to spread my enthusiasm to everyone else.
So you actually finished successfully defending your dissertation like in the second week of our class. So you're officially a doctor now. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So what are all of your degrees specifically in?
Yeah, so my undergraduate degree was in environmental science, and it was part science, but also part relating science to policy and nonprofit organizations. So I worked for a few places during my time at NYU, which is where I did my undergrad, and I worked a little bit with the Parks Department, and I worked with New York City Audubon. And then I decided to go to Fordham University for my dissertation, which is where I got my PhD in biological sciences, more specifically ecology and evolution. So how different organisms interact and how they're all related to one another.
That's so real. Speaking of your dead violet, do you have plants now?
Yes, I do.
How many do you have? Do you have any favorites?
I think my peace lily might be my favorite. Mm-hmm. It was a gift from my mom. It was her peace lily. And aww. I think one of the reasons that it's my favorite is, one, my mom trusted me to take her plant, you know, and she's this plant expert. So I felt very privileged that she would give me one of her plants. And now I feel like that pressure has prevented me from being able to kill it or, you know, anything like that. But they also, peace lilies are super interesting because they basically tell you what they need. They droop over when they need more water. They tell, you know, if they haven't flowered in a while, that tells you something. And so I just think that they're an interesting plant to take care of.
Yeah, they're a really underrated starter plant because they're also low light tolerant. So I think people who don't understand their natural light that they get yet, I feel like people think that's like one of the like old plants of the 70s that like isn't fun anymore, but they still flower and they still have gorgeous foliage and they are exactly very communicative. And fun fact that we learned in Intro to Plant Science, the flower, the spadix is actually, it's not a petal, right? The white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
So I learned it from you.
Yeah. So the main petal looking organ on a peace lily is actually a leaf. And you could see that when you first watch a peace lily flower bloom. The leaf is green and then it unfurls itself and it reveals this spike in the middle. And actually the spike in the middle is itself the combination of many flowers that go along this cylinder. And so really the petals are on that tiny, tiny little cylinder and they're like these microscopic little petals. And the thing that we think is the petal is just a leaf that lost its chlorophyll.
Yeah. Like I feel like the overarching thing that we'll dive into in a little bit that I learned in this class is like many things that I think are leaves and petals are not leaves and petals. Like that's the biggest, one of my biggest takeaways. So yeah. And that's this, it's the spathe, right? The spadix?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So fun fact number one, there's going to be so many fun facts. And also I feel like I'm really starting to annoy my fiance and my mom with all the fun facts I'm learning. They're like, we don't care. And I'm like, well, my listeners are going to care. So I'm going to talk to Elle about it.
That's okay. Even my, the people that I work with who are true plant biologists and botanists, I still tell them fun facts, even though I learn them from them as if they had never heard them before, because I just get so excited every time I teach the class.
It's so cool. So the way I think we should do this is let's talk about some overarching concepts that blew my mind and some like bigger ideas that I think our community will benefit from kind of diving in depth. And then throughout the 7 weeks of our class, I was taking notes on a Word document. And at the bottom of the Word document, I literally had a running list called mind-blowing facts that in the midst of like in real time of you lecturing us, when I learned something that like really blew my mind, I would just like scribble it down. So I have all of these scribbles. So I was thinking we'll do overarching thoughts. And then I want to share all of the mind-blowing facts with the listeners and have you kind of elaborate on what they all are. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds great.
So the first concept that I loved learning about, and the timing of this class was perfect because I was actually germinating seeds for my garden, as we talked about, but the concept of monocots and dicots and cotyledons, because I feel like that was the first kind of fact that I learned that I was like, oh, whoa. So when you germinate a seed and you put it in the ground, those first two things that we think are leaves are in fact not leaves, but they're the cotyledon.
Yes.
And within all of the plants, they all break down into two different types of plants, monocots, right? Yeah, monocots and dicots. Those are the only two. And then all the plants are one of those two, right?
Yeah, those are the two major groups. And then, of course, the rebel plants that don't fit into either category.
Mm-hmm. But of the plants that we have, the plants that we know, you know, our vegetables that we're growing, our perennials, our flowers, they're all broken down into monocots and dicots. And it's super easy to, not super easy, but generally there are some general guidelines for understanding how it works. So can you give an overarching kind of general description of germination? Because I think what we know is you take your seeds and you put them in a wet paper towel and you put the paper towel in a Ziploc. And in a few days, it will have sprouted. And then you put that sprout in the soil.
Right.
Then Intro to Plant Science kind of filled in the blanks there.
Yeah. So I think the first thing to think about is really what is the seed, right? So what is it that you're working with? You go to the store, you buy a packet of seeds, and you go to throw them in the ground. And really, the first thing that probably blows people's minds is that not all plants have seeds.
Right.
And actually, it's only a two major groups, right? The gymnosperms and the angiosperms that have true seeds, right? And the goal of the seed is to protect the baby plant, right? To wait for conditions to be perfect, right? So that's why seeds can, you can have them in your drawer, you know, after you get them from the store and you don't actually have to plant them right away. And then once you do plant them, usually they tend to germinate pretty well. And that's essentially the goal of what the seed is. And so it consists of the baby plant, right? Which oftentimes we call the cotyledon. Mm-hmm. And are also known as seed leaves, right? They're not true leaves, but they're seed leaves. And then this thing called the endosperm, which is really the majority of what the seed is made out of. And that is some tissue that surrounds the embryo. It's filled with lots of goodies like starch, oil, and proteins. And essentially, as I kind of described in class, it's the goodie bag
the
that
goodie
mom
bag.
Packed you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that you can rely on those resources until your faithful gardener plants you and gives you all the things you need for growth, right? So it's like the goodie bag to hold you over. And so when you're a dicot, you have two cotyledons, which is why it's called dicot, right? Two cotyledons. And then of course we have our monocots, which have one cotyledon. And the shape of the seed is a little bit different. And so the typical dicot seed that most people recognize is the idea of a bean, like a lima bean, where you could clearly see that you could divide it into two halves. Mm-hmm. And an example of a monocot is probably something more like corn, right? An individual corn kernel, right? That's kind of hard to divide in half. There's no real identity of a place where you could cut it. And so that's probably a good idea that it's probably a monocot. And then depending on which it is, it might have a different way in which it germinates. And so there's a number of things that, you know, of course, plants need or seeds need in order to germinate, right? They need good water sources. They need a good temperature. They need the right location. And a lot of people don't realize why seeds need water. And one of the things is that they not only need water, but they need some kind of process by which the water gets underneath that hard coat that's on the outside of the seed. If the water isn't able to get underneath the seed coat, say because you didn't scratch it or you just had to give it some mechanical pressure, then it's just going to sit in a bunch of water. So actually what you want is the water to get underneath the seed coat, and then it swells and allows the water to interact with everything that's happening on the inside of the seed.
Right. So that's it. That's germination. And So that's why I feel like, I guess when people tell us, make sure that when you're starting seeds that you keep the soil more moist than normal, that moisture is what's helping the seeds swell and break through that seed coat.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So monocots and dicots show themselves. I mean, there's processes in their germination with like how they express themselves that we don't have to dive into. Take the class if you want to go that nerdy. But I thought it was interesting that monocots, orchids are monocots. And so monocots, you can tell by their leaves for the most part. If the veins on the leaf are parallel, it's likely a monocot. And if the veins on a leaf are, what's it called?
When they're like netted or branched,
right. Then they're dicots, and orchids are one of the largest groups of monocots. And orchids, as we know, do have those leaves with those parallel veins.
Mm-hmm.
And then the root systems generally are, you can also break up. So a monocot has a tap root and a dicot has a fibrous root, right? I didn't mess that up.
Yes. Yes. So dicots usually have that tap root, right? Which is a really large root that goes straight down into the soil. It's much thicker than all the other roots. And then the monocots have those fibrous roots, which generally are kind of more on the surface of the soil.
Right. So when we stick our germinated seeds in the soil and those first two leaves pop out, those are the cotyledons. So you're going to see two of them in a dicot and one in a monocot. It's going to look different. And then those actually aren't leaves. They do photosynthesize, but then they fall off, right? And the true leaves are going to be the next two leaves that come out.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of depends, because some monocots, the cotyledon technically stays under the ground, right?
Right, right.
And so you don't fully see those seed leaves, but something that does first emerge is what's called the epicotyl, right?
Right, the epicotyl.
Right, which are those like basic baby seed leaves that help it to start to photosynthesize, but they're not true leaves. Yep.
Yeah, fun fact, like whatever those first two leaf looking like things, they're not leaves, and that they'll actually die off. And I'm watching that happen with my peas and my beans right now, is that those first
epicotyl.
epicotyl and the cotyledons are now like yellow and falling off.
Yeah. I like to think of it as like baby teeth and adult teeth, right? So like,
oh yeah, that's cute.
Yeah, like the baby teeth grow in and they serve a little purpose for a little while, but they're not going to help you sustain your chewing for your whole life. And so then you need the real guns, which are the adult teeth.
Yeah. So all of our plants that we know and love start like that. So it's interesting to be able to now look at the patterns on the leaves or look at the roots and kind of have this better understanding of who they are. Oh, and another, the flowers, right? Mm-hmm. A monocot has three petals and a dicot has groups of four or five, right?
Yes.
Can you tell I just studied for the final? I'm so happy we did that. But yeah, so there's these fun different ways that you can kind of break it down, but it's really fun. It just brought a different level to germinating seeds and planting up my garden. I felt like I owned it a lot more, like having that understanding, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think any little bit of knowledge you can have to better understand the plants that you're working with is exciting for you. And it's probably exciting for the plant because it'll get better care.
Exactly. So obviously, when you think of plant science, the next topic, photosynthesis, finally having an understanding of photosynthesis. I've done many episodes on grow lights and the science of light and understanding your natural light. So we've gone through photosynthesis before, but I feel like the class and learning more in depth kind of gave me, I feel like you can finally understand the overarching concept of it. And the interesting thing that photosynthesis and cellular respiration, which is something we hear a lot about plants, are essentially negating each other. So these plants mm-hmm. have these processes that are constantly kind of undoing each other, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that life has a way of, it's checks and balances. So for every way there is to do something, there's a way to undo it.
Right. So, okay, let me try and say this now that the final is over. So, photosynthesis is happening in the chloroplasts of the plant. So that's like where the green is in a plant. And it's taking light, it's taking carbon dioxide, which is CO2, and water, mm-hmm. and it's making sugars that the plant eats and oxygen.
Yep.
And the plant is using that oxygen.
Yeah,
right?
they use a little bit of it, but they give a lot of it off, which is kind of
and
that
they
idea
release
that,
it.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
the idea
one
that
of the
plants,
benefits.
Right. The idea that plants are releasing oxygen into us. Into the atmosphere. And then you have cellular respiration, which plants also do, which takes the sugars that they made and oxygen.
Yes.
Breaks them down into carbon dioxide and water. So they're also releasing carbon dioxide.
Yes.
And that was an interesting conversation we had in class, because I remember listening to someone talk about how like having plants can actually harm you because they could release too much carbon dioxide like while you sleep and choke you.
Yeah, I don't think that's probably true. So one of the real, you know, the ideas that having houseplants, they don't necessarily clean your air, but that's mostly because most people don't have enough houseplants in their house to have that happen. Mm-hmm. But I think what a lot of people don't realize, and actually something that I talk about in my tree communication class, is that plants are emitting a lot more things than just oxygen and carbon dioxide. And that one of those things are these things called VOCs, or volatile organic compounds, which are basically these little molecules that are gaseous that they put out into the air to communicate with one another. So your plant might be cleaning the air, sort of, but they're also producing a lot of VOCs in their communication with one another.
Now, aren't they absorbing VOCs as well, though?
They are. Yes, they are.
So this was something that we talked about in class as well, because there's all of this controversy. NASA in the 80s released this study proving that plants clean the air. But the study was done in had very specific controls. And some of it was like in outer space, or the studies were done to try and like clean air in space.
Yes.
And so they released kind of these studies that were then kind of taken, and everyone like took these studies and ran with it. So then these books were published on how plants clean the air and how different plants clean different aspects of the air. And that's kind of now like a well-known fact. That's something I've educated people on before, how like plants clean the air. So you should have plants. But now people are starting to be like, wait, this was a massive amount of plants in like an airtight chamber. And if you have 10 house plants in your apartment, those plants are not filtering the air enough for you to actually experience a benefit.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that kind of the dialogue that's happening right now? And do you kind of have a stance on it?
Yeah. So one of the problems with the NASA study is that the idea was that it was done in what's called an airtight chamber, because that's to replicate the conditions on a spaceship, right? Because there's no breathable air in space, so we need to keep it airtight. But of course, where we live, there's tons of air exchange. And so for everything the plant takes in, there's constantly going to be more air being exchanged from the outside that's coming in, right? And so the net benefit that the plant can provide really isn't seeing its full potential in our houses, is basically what's happening. There's just much more air exchange than we even realize happening from outside to inside. And plants definitely provide a benefit. I just don't think it necessarily is an air quality.
Yeah. Like, in their natural processes, I feel like I can never say that word right. They are like, in effect, cleaning the air, releasing oxygen, breaking down VOCs, but not to an extent that, like, it's not wrong to say that this is something plants can do, because the study did prove that the plants can do it in really specific conditions. But understanding that we're not in the airtight chamber conditions of the study is important, because it's understanding that my New York City apartment, where I have an air conditioner that filters the air from outside and cools it down and blows it in and then takes it back out, is going to look, any filtration that my plants might have done, like, is immediately kind of negated by that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that the bottom line comes down to, you would have to cover your house in plants to see that benefit. So imagine, right, the benefit that they're talking about happens all the time in forests. Right? Because the plants are the dominant organism in the forest. And like, it's, the forest is covered with plants, but you'd have to take your apartment and turn it into a forest.
Right.
Like, that same amount of plant cover to reach those same benefits.
Right. And you know, I have 150 plants in 500 square feet. Like, I've got a lot, but I still think that my air quality is probably not great. Like, I think it would take an enormous amount of plants. But also, I feel like where I stand on it is, I would rather have 150 plants in my apartment neutralizing what they can while I live in New York City than none. Right. Like, I feel like having some plants, not even, I'm so extra with 150, but like 10 plants is better than no plants, just in terms of air quality, I guess, right? I mean, is that safe to say?
Yeah.
I think? You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutrigreens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutrigreens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutrigreens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today.
I think the plants do a lot of things that we don't even fully understand yet. Mm-hmm. I think that having some plants is definitely better than having no plants. Mm-hmm. And of course, they provide a bunch of other benefits. So beyond the air quality, it's always good to have plants because, you know, they teach you all these other things. So definitely, totally. I'm a plant fan.
Yes, everyone needs to successfully care for plants in the Bloom and Grow yes. Radio world. That's my belief. So that's kind of overarching photosynthesis and cellular respiration, but it really knocks home that your plants need to do photosynthesis in order to survive and make the sugars that they live off of. So if you aren't giving your plant adequate light, you're literally not giving it food. Like you have to kind of think about it that way. Like you could fertilize it all you want and give whatever NPK in the soil, but if you don't give it that light source, your plant is not going to be happy.
Yeah. And there's definitely, it's this idea of giving your plant a balanced diet and knowing that there's three main things that go into photosynthesis, right? So carbon dioxide, which you can't really control as someone living in an apartment. Okay. So we'll put that one to the side. There's plenty of carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
But water, right? That's one of the main reasons you need to water your plants. And a lot of people don't realize, they think, oh, it's just so it doesn't dry out, which definitely is important, but it's needed for photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. So water's super important. And then of course, light.
Right. The three big ones, baby. That's it. Yes. You can figure out how to manage that. You can figure out how to keep plants alive. So then another larger concept I wanted to talk to you about, and also I would love your scientific thoughts on this just because I, in my very emotional being, have just been thinking about the concept of dormancy a lot, like as a human.
Yes.
And I see parallels. I have a whole series on my podcast of like life lessons learned in the garden and parallels that you can take from plants. But so dormancy, one thing you showed us in class, which I thought was so interesting, is there were seeds that were dormant and found mm-hmm. that were how old? How many thousand years old? The palm tree Ooh. That you showed us?
Yeah, I think it was, you're talking about Methuselah.
Yeah.
Yes, Methuselah, 2,000 years old, 2,000.
So when we talk about dormancy, these seeds, so a seed, which is essentially an embryo covered in protective matter that the seed has designed mm-hmm. or a plant has designed, these seeds will be patient AF if they need to be. And the thing that you had showed us was this 2,000-year-old seed that was discovered like in a crypt or something, right? That then was germinated
and grown. Yeah, it was found in an archaeological dig. They were digging up an ancient civilization, I think in Mesopotamia. And this archaeologist found this pot of seeds in the dig. And so he decided to take them home and he planted one of them. And now it's his office plant and he named it Methuselah and it's become very famous. So you can go find National Geographic has covered this one palm plant named Methuselah.
Yeah, I mean, so wild. So I guess we can look at dormancy two ways. Dormancy in a seed that has not germinated, and then dormancy in plants that experience a dormant period. So they grow and then they die back and then they grow again. So why is dormancy important for plants?
Yeah, so I think plants, they don't have the benefit that we have in the case that when conditions aren't great for us, we can get up and leave. Mm-hmm. Right? And we can search out better conditions. But plants don't really, they can move somewhat, right? Like vines climbing, but they really can't pick up roots and go somewhere else.
Get in their car and drive away. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so the plants need to have these mechanisms by which they can survive, even if conditions get pretty bad. And so that's really the role of dormancy. Dormancy is cutting back what we need to survive to the bare minimum to get through this bad time and then come back even stronger after dormancy, waiting for the ideal conditions. And it's a very powerful thing that not all plants have, right? And a number of plants are quite susceptible to changing situations, right? These are things like our annuals that only live maybe for 1 year. But mm-hmm. if you're going to live longer than that,
is dormancy an adaptation?
Yeah, I think I would consider it an adaptation. I mean, I feel like dormancy is a little bit of what we call a plastic trait, and that it's pretty malleable, you know, what a plant might do during dormancy, how long that dormancy might be, because it's a response to the conditions. But definitely not all plants can go dormant. So I would definitely call it an adaptation.
Okay. So we had a listener question right in saying, how do you tell the difference between when your plant is dormant and when your plant is dead?
Yes.
Any tips?
Yes. So what happens to a plant when it goes dormant? Well, the first thing that it's going to lose are its leaves. And that freaks people out because mm-hmm. they think, oh my God, that's the first sign of death. But really, it's a sign that the plant is cutting back on things it doesn't need, right? If a plant can barely reach its base status quo needs, it's definitely not going to keep up the structures like leaves that are for extra stuff. And so it's going to drop its leaves. That's the first sign. And so, okay, you have a plant now that's dropped its leaves. How do you tell if it's dead? Well, one is the scratch test, right? So you can look at a branch and you can kind of scratch it back or try to bend it, right? The snap and scratch test to see if it's still water conducting, right? So it should have some give to it. It shouldn't be dry and snap right away. And if you scratch it back, you should see some green underneath your branch. And if at the very top of the plant, you don't see it, you slowly move down the plant as you get closer to the roots. And that's important because if all else fails and the above ground part of your plant seems like it's dead, you could always dig up a small part of the lower part of the plant or take it out of its pot to check its roots. So if its roots still look good, that's the best way to tell that it's still alive, right? And that it's in its dormant phase because it's hiding, you know, its growth under the ground, similar to what we would do, right? It's hunkering down for unfavorable conditions. It's going where it's safe, which is under the ground where it's protected by the soil.
Okay. Because I think like oxalis is a house plant that a lot of people have that famously has a dormancy period. And, you know, it has these gorgeous leaves. And then all of a sudden, like everything just topples over and you think that it's dead. But
right.
You're just supposed to let it chill until it pops back, you know? Mm-hmm. So the plant is alive. It's or it's not dormant. It's open. It's photosynthesizing. Does it make enough sugars to store to then get through the dormancy period like a bear hibernates? Like, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, generally plants make more sugars than they use right away. So they're definitely always the goal is to have good, when conditions are good, it's full steam ahead to store up as much sugar as possible because you never know when conditions are going to take a turn for the worse.
Okay, got it. And then for them to wake back up after their dormancy, is it an external factor that triggers that? Or is it, oh, I've run out of sugars. It's time for me to wake up and photosynthesize more?
No, unfortunately, that's not the case. The growth, right? So in dormancy, growth slows to basically a minimum, and it's just trying to keep up the cells that it does have and the tissues that it does have. And so when it's time to break dormancy, it needs some kind of signal. Usually it's a moisture signal or a temperature signal, but it could be waiting and waiting for a really long time and use up all its sugars, and it still doesn't have the right conditions. And so there are a number of plants that they have a certain window in which their dormancy can happen. But then, of course, there are other plants like Japanese maple, for instance, that usually is used to experiencing a seasonal dormancy. But a number of people like Japanese maple as ornamental plants, and they'll take, you know, a smaller version of the tree inside, which changes, you know, it's not getting those environmental cues to go dormant. And so it could continue to grow without experiencing dormancy for 2 years, but eventually the plant knows, okay, I've had enough stress, and it will put itself into dormancy. Even if it still has all the conditions that it needs for growth, it'll know it needs a break.
Interesting. I think about that a lot with grow lights in our apartments. Yes. And I mean, here's the thing with having houseplants, like these plants aren't meant to be inside. They're mostly meant to be in the tropical jungle and we're bringing them in. So like they're set up for failure. Like when you think about it that way, like not our apartments are not the tropical jungle, no matter how many humidifiers we have. So like,
right.
I don't think it's fair to like be hard on ourselves for that because that's just the hobby. But sometimes I think about my grow lights where like my plants that are under my grow lights are not experiencing any change in light. Cause at least if you're in a windowsill, you're experiencing the different angles of the sun for winter, summer, mm-hmm. spring. You're understanding, you know, the sun's strength is different in the different seasons, especially in New York. But with these grow lights, you're not, you know, they're not. And I wonder if that's mean to the plant or not.
They've been, you know, living without us for long periods of time and, mm-hmm. and they're across the globe in all these weird environments. So I think the Japanese maple that I just described is a great example. It'll tell you when time right. has come for dormancy because, you know, it'll grow, but eventually it knows it needs a break and it will put itself into dormancy even mm-hmm. when you think, oh, it's summer, it should be growing. So,
right. And that's definitely, I've seen something with my citrus who like citrus are plants that are very seasonal, like they're very seasonal and they take those external mm-hmm. stimulus. And then when you grow them indoors, I never know when we're getting a lime or when we're getting a lemon or
yeah.
whenever, you know, it could be,
yeah.
they don't give two shits about what season it is outdoors. So
right.
it's interesting. Is there a definition of dormancy?
I'm not sure if there's necessarily a hard and fast rule, but I think the best way to characterize it, and I think a lot of plant biologists and botanists would say, it's when the plant really isn't growing, it's sustaining.
Okay. So it's right? not so like it's, a lack of a bloom. It's a lack of growth.
Yeah, right. It's kind of just maintaining the status quo. It's not doing anything extra. It's not growing in any one direction. It's just kind of maintaining what it has.
So my orchid plant that is currently growing a new leaf, but it doesn't have any blooms, it's not dormant because it's growing a leaf.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so also like when I think about dormancy, so I've been thinking a lot about dormancy, especially in this period of pandemic where like a yes. lot of aspects of our life, like my life as a musical theater performer is dormant and will probably be dormant for a while until like people can go to the theater again. And I've just right. kind of been thinking about what that means and knowing that like you said, like a plant needs to go dormant because it's exhausted and prepare for another season of bloom, which like, is the next season going to be after dormant? Like, is there preparations happening or is it simply asleep? Like, can you help me with this metaphor I'm working through?
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily like hibernation in an animal, but in some ways, right? So even in hibernation, it's not the same thing as death, right? So the cells are still working. They're still sensing environmental stimuli. They're still doing their basic things that they need to upkeep the body mm-hmm. of the plant. They're just not being extra. They're right. not going to grow their flowers. They're not going to grow their leaves. They're really not going to grow their roots. They're just storing and preparing.
Mm-hmm. But it mm-hmm. is a preparation and it's a necessary preparation. And I feel like just with life, like whatever season people are in, also like not all plants bloom at the same time. Like there yes. needs to be these layered periods of dormancy for different types of plants to create a sustainable ecological system for us to live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there's benefits and cons to the both ways of life, right? So an annual lives fast and furious. It has a glorious life, but it's very short, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas a dicot or even something like a tree, the early life of a tree is actually pretty stinky in terms of you're so much smaller than everyone else around you, all the other trees, and your moment in the sun, you're literally waiting for your moment in the sun, right? You have to wait yeah. for someone to die and fall over for you to really see your full potential.
Yeah.
So trees, they could be 30 years old, but still look super young and very scraggly because their growth is limited, right? Mm-hmm. In that sense. And so I think definitely there's benefits and drawbacks to either plant life as well as with your own life, but.
Totally. Is that a thing? Monocots are annuals? And are most monocots annuals that you just said? And then dicots are perennials or no?
I don't know if it falls that nicely as with mm-hmm. some of the other things.
Okay.
I feel like annual and perennial, it can really vary. So the dicots and monocots can fall into both.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, thank you for entertaining my deep thoughts that I'm working through for another episode I want to do on dormancy.
Yes.
Okay. So here now, like just some fun, mind-blowing moments that we can talk about for our listeners. So, okay. A lot of the things that we think are leaves are not leaves. So like we mentioned, those first two cotyledons that we thought are leaves are actually not. And then, so this really blew my mind. Celery and onions, the layers of an onion that we think are the, like, what is it, a root? An onion, I guess, is a root vegetable, right?
It's a bulb.
A tuber, a bulb. So yes. Those are altered leaves.
Yes.
That was really interesting. So how does that process happen that, like, an onion is actually a leaf instead of a, I guess, what would you think an onion is? Maybe a petal? Or I guess it's an altered something because it's not a stem. So there's roots and shoots. Yeah. There's roots and shoots and then everything in between, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are a number of vegetables or things in the grocery store where the stem is very hard to find. Right. So the two examples are celery and onion, or basically a number of bulb plants. And so the stem of an onion is really just that hard plate at the bottom of the onion. That's the stem.
Right. The thing that you chop off.
Yeah. Yeah. And then all the other, like, fleshy layers are just the leaves. Right. And as you go towards the inside, right, they get more condensed and they're a little bit harder. And that's because they gained all these layers that are now pressing in towards the inner part of the onion.
So the inner part of the onion is the older part of the onion.
Yes.
Interesting. And then, so that was interesting. And then another modified leaf that I didn't understand was a modified leaf is cacti spines.
Yes. Yes.
Can you explain the evolution there, the adaptation there?
Yeah. So, and I think this is something that we've only really known about fairly recently, like in the last decade. We've always had some hypotheses, right? So if you look at a cactus, where are its leaves, right? It's hard to find them. And so the major organ that does photosynthesis in a plant is usually the leaves. But if a cactus has no leaves, where does it do it? Well, it does it in its stem, right? The majority of a cactus is made of its stem. And so then what of its leaves, right? And so instead of having lots of leaves, which can do lots of photosynthesis in a desert where a cactus normally lives, that wouldn't really be that beneficial because as you do photosynthesis, you also lose a lot of water. And water is something that's limited in a desert. So having lots of leaves isn't beneficial. So that's why they have this giant stem where they store lots of water. But now they have a giant goodie bag filled with water, right? And water is limited not only for plants in a desert, but also for animals. And so they need to protect that scarce resource of water against everyone else that wants to try to eat it and suck it out like a straw. And so instead of having all these bushy leaves that do photosynthesis, their leaves have the same DNA that general leaves would have, but they turn off their leafy tissue and they turn on the tissue responsible for making wood that, you know, trees make. And so instead, their leaves have this woody texture and the spine-like texture to provide protection to hold on and keep their water source for safe keeping. And so, yeah, so they have these woody leaves instead of these nice foliage, you know, thin leaves that you would normally think of.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people know that, you know, it's an adaptation to ward off animals that might want to nibble on them. But that was really interesting. And then another cactus fun fact, because we are houseplant people and we love cacti.
Yeah. That,
well, two cactus fun facts. So one thing I had written down, I think you have to remind me why though. Something, so the barrel cactus, which is one of my favorite types of cacti, I wrote down accordion folds allow for swelling, more stomata are available for photosynthesis.
Yeah. So usually when you look at the two most common cacti probably are the saguaro cactus, right? That you like always see in those desert images with the arms.
That looks like the arms.
And then the barrel cactus. And both of those have this adaptation of this accordion-like skin, right? So it looks wavy on the outside. And essentially, that gives extra surface area so that the plant can swell with water when water is available and it will store it all year round. And since it's taking up water so quickly, right, if it didn't have these accordion-like folds, it would burst, right?
Right.
Because it wouldn't have enough space to stretch. And so the accordion-like folds allow extra space for swelling. But the other benefit is that you want to do photosynthesis when water is abundant because you need it to do photosynthesis. And so the idea is that as it swells, more outside edges of its stem, which are the structure that has these pores that exchange the gases and that help to do photosynthesis, those are called stomata, those become more exposed, right? They're not tucked into the folds as much. And because they're on the stem and it's a desert environment, generally they have less stomata or they're smaller or they're covered with this waxy texture. And so just simply by swelling and stretching, it just gives certain stomata that weren't open and accessed availability, right, to do this gas exchange. And it's well-timed with when water is available.
I love that. Fun facts this whole episode. I just love a barrel cactus. I just think it's so mesmerizing to look straight down at one and look at how perfectly symmetrical, just the patterns that they make. It's pretty mesmerizing. And then one more cactus fun tip. So of the thorns or spines that we see in a cactus, there's actually three different types. There's thorns, spines, and prickles, right?
Yeah. So cacti generally have spines, but plants in general, they could have three types of sharp things that we just think are sharp, but they're actually three different types of structures.
Right. And it has to do with if it sits, a spine versus a thorn is, does it sit on top or below the leaf?
Yes.
And which is which? A spine is below the leaf.
Yes.
And then a prickle is kind of curved.
Yes.
And then one of the fun facts that I have written down is everyone says roses have thorns, but actually roses have prickles.
Yes, exactly.
Which are just like a different type of pointy thing. But roses technically don't have thorns. And how many songs and poems talk about roses and their thorns? You know, how many inspirational quotes? So I thought that was a really fun fact too.
Yeah, definitely. And really one of the main ways, the real distinguishable feature of these from a scientific perspective is what type of tissue are these structures made from? Are they modified versions of the stem? Are they modified versions of the leaf? Are they just modified versions of the outer epidermis, you know, the skin layer of the plant? So really that's scientifically why we have all these different terms, but to the naked eye, they pretty much all look the same.
Right. So interesting. I just love it. And then another thing that we talked a lot about, which we don't have to like dive in because I feel like we just did a deep dive on leaves, but we had the most fun class where you dissected a bunch of different flowers for us and we looked at a bunch of different flower diagrams. But what a lot of plants that we think are plant petals are actually another structure called the sepal.
Yes. The flower leaves.
The flower leaf. So the sepal is the leaf that like when it's a tiny bud, kind of wraps around the bud to protect
it. Yes.
And then it opens up and then the petals are formed opened up. And we think that to be a flower petal, you have to just, it's just like whatever color the flower petal is. But like on a lily actually has three petals and three sepals. And that's really weird and interesting.
Yeah. And the sepals, they start out green, right? Because they're leaves. And then when the petals open and it doesn't necessarily need to photosynthesize anymore, the sepals lose that chlorophyll, that green color. And instead it reveals all the other pigments. So the sepals look just like the petals.
So I think it's really fun for people if, you know, the next time you buy grocery store flowers or the next time you're in your garden or your mom's garden and you see a lily, pay attention to what that bud looks like before it opens. Because normally with grocery store flowers, you always can buy one with a closed bud and watch and see if it's actually sepals that open and then watch their colors drain. Or is it actually a petal?
Yeah. It's really cool.
And then another example you gave, which is a flower that I love, the sea lavender, which are those like kind of harder purple flowers that you see in a lot of flower arrangements. The purple flowers are all sepals, and then they have little white flowers within the purple flowers. And those are the flowers that have the actual sexual organs of, is it organ? Yeah, sexual parts.
Yes.
Of the flower. And then all of the purple structures that we think are flowers are actually sepals. And they're like a diversion for the white flower.
Yes. Yeah. And they have that like papery, they literally feel like tissue paper. They don't even feel real, but they'll be there before the flower, the petals bloom, and they'll be there after the petals fall off.
Right. Which is, I think, why we see them in a lot of floral arrangements, because they're like hardy and they like stay in water. Mm-hmm. Like they won't die back as fast.
Yeah.
So those are all of my mind-blowing moments there. Okay. So here is like the biggest one that I'm obsessed with and told my mom about three times when we were in her garden this weekend. So for the last 3 years, I've been told prune your plant back, it instigates growth. Prune your plant back, it'll make it grow more. But I've never really understood why, and I've never really understood where or how to prune it. And you told me. So I want to let, I feel like I'm explaining a lot of these things. So do you want to explain apical dog?
Sure. Yeah. Okay,
cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think about this as like the captain of a ship and a bunch of the other people that like row the ship, or the people doing the labor or whatever. And in a plant, there's one main tip of the plant, right? At the top of the stem, and that's called the apical meristem. It's responsible for much of the growth that happens in a plant. It's the tallest part of the plant, so it can sense light and changing conditions better than, you know, other parts of the plant. And that's really the captain. And that captain has this control that's called apical dominance, right? Because he's on the apical bud. And his job is to control the lateral buds, aka all the like minions, right? That are along the side of the plant, right? So those buds that, you know, grow different branches and leaves along the sides of the plant. And so really one of the things that the apical bud does is it produces a hormone known as auxin, which is very important. If you learn one thing about plant hormones, it should be about auxin, because it will definitely help you take care of your plants. Mm-hmm. And so the apical bud produces this auxin, and it controls when it grows, the direction of its growth, right? So up and down, right? Or lateral growth, right? So the fattening of a plant. And so if you want your plant, say it's gotten too out of control, it's gotten too stretched out vertically, you can chop off the captain, right? Throw him overboard, and then someone else needs to now be in control. And so there's a bit of craziness that might happen in between, where you get a lot of lateral growth or fattening or thickening of your plant, because there isn't this captain keeping all of the minions under control anymore, right? So it's all about the spread of auxin, this hormone auxin, and which bud is the bud that's controlling everything else in the plant.
Right. So you basically behead the top, the apical bud, and then the auxin like runs up and down the stem saying, everybody else grow, everybody else grow.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's why when you cut off the top of a stem of your plant, you're going to get all of that growth. So some people think like when you propagate your, like you see this a lot when you propagate your plants, you cut off the end of it. And then all of a sudden that whole stem of leaves all of a sudden is growing all sorts of new offshoots.
Yes.
But with the pruning, it's all about cutting that top of the, cutting that, the tippity top of the plant off, that apical bud, to make sure that that auxin gets released, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, eventually the plant will produce a new apical bud, right? Someone else will eventually rise to the top to be the bud that's in control and controls the lateral growth of the plant. But definitely when you remove that apical bud, you're kind of releasing some of that auxin that's been held up in the apical bud. And now it's increasing the growth of these other parts of the plant.
Right. So it's all about this hormone. And I didn't even know plants had hormones. So it's so interesting to see that these five main hormones are responsible for so many things. Another mind-blowing thing with auxin is we're told to constantly, every couple of weeks, rotate your plant a quarter of a circle so the plant's leaves don't all grow towards your windowsill. And you explained, so that's something called phototropism, which auxin is responsible for, and auxin moves away from the light, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Yes. So auxin doesn't like light. This is like literally how I talk through studying for this with myself. So auxin doesn't like light. So when you put your plants in a windowsill, auxin is going to sense the sun coming from whatever direction the window is, and it's going to rush to the other side of the plant. And that's going to cause the plant to elongate and then stretch its leaves towards the direction of the sun.
Yeah, right? It's basically like, imagine all the auxin is equally distributed at that point in the plant. But when you only give it light from one angle, all that auxin runs away from the light and it only goes to one side. So now imagine only having growth hormone on one half of your body, right?
Right.
So that's what causes the bending, is because only one half of the plant actually is growing and the other half isn't. And so it causes it to bend towards the light, which is beneficial, right? Because then the plant is just getting more access to light, which it needs for photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's what's actually happening within the plant when we're rotating, or everybody complains, oh, my plant keeps stretching towards the light. Or does it also have to do with if a plant isn't getting enough light and it starts reaching, like the nodes get longer? Does auxin play into that as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's that and also that some other hormones, right, that we talked about. So things like gibberellins, which are another hormone that can create this, what many people call bolting, or this like elongating and stretching of a plant, right? It's not getting what it needs and it's trying to access those things. And it uses hormones to communicate to all the cells in the body to create coordinated movement, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My friend, who's not a plant person, she's one of my performing friends, sent me this picture of her Monstera adansonii, which is kind of a rare plant that she has. And I taught her how to train it up her wall, and she's trained it up her wall. And then all of a sudden she sent me these photos of it like yellowing, and also the nodes are so long. Like the wall trained it up is basically in the dark. Like it's a corner that doesn't get any light. And so the plant had these long stems. I think she moved the plant into this low light thing and then attached the stems to the wall. And now you can see like the new leaves are so small and they're so far apart from each other. And that's like the biggest indicator that it's not getting the right light. So auxin, along with other hormones, is playing into that.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. Interesting. See, we're putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. Okay. Another mind-blowing thing that I had to tell my family about on a walk, and they were all like, we don't care. So the rings of a tree. So we all know xylem and phloem are probably familiar names to all of us. There is in the middle of our plant stems, and the water and nutrients flow up and down. But the rings of a tree are rings of xylem and phloem.
So the rings of a tree are alternating versions of xylem.
Right, right.
Right. Yeah. So the phloem is on a different, they're further out, closer to the
bottom. Right, the phloem is on the other side of the cambium. Sorry. So it's the xylem. Right, sorry.
Yeah, and so what many people don't realize is there's two types of xylem that trees form, which is how we get the terms early wood and late wood.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's like the wood that grows, the xylem tissue that grows during the different growing seasons, early in the growing season and late in the growing season. Mm-hmm. And the cell structure is actually different. So early in the growing season, when all the conditions are pretty favorable, we get these really long cells that take up a lot of space, and they have thin cell walls, which creates this like light texture of the tree ring. And then that dark ring, which is the ring we actually associate with tree rings, is the late wood, which is, you know, doesn't grow as much because it's in later in the season when conditions are starting to dwindle. And it's very, very dense growth, very small cells. And the cells have really thick cell walls to prepare for being able to overwinter. And so that alteration is what we see as the rings. And fun fact, if you grow a deciduous plant like a tree that should have rings, if you grow it in an area where there isn't a major difference between hot and cold and different changes throughout the year, it won't make rings. It'll just always have early wood. And so it'll never get that dark ring, which blows people's mind.
That blew my mind. Because I'm, you know, born and raised in New York, so I see rings on trees all the time. But if I was coming from Florida or California or Mexico or somewhere where it's much more warm, there's a lack of seasons, then it's crazy to me to think that like the trees in Florida don't have rings on them. And I know that's insane to say, but like it is just kind of weird. So that, I thought that was so fun. And then another tree related thing, I wrote it down, but I actually don't remember why. I have maple syrup in colder climates means that the tree has more sugar in the sap.
Yeah. So one of the mechanisms that trees use to overwinter in cold climates is, so deciduous trees, they're going to make lots of sugar during their favorable growing season, and then they're going to store that sugar over winter so they can use it to grow their leaves back in the spring before they have photosynthetic tissue. And coniferous trees, which can grow all year round, that although their growth is definitely slowed in the winter, right? They have their needles all year round, live in really, really cold climates, but they don't want the water in their cells, like in their xylem, to freeze, right? Because when water freezes, it expands and it can burst their cells and it can cause damage to the plant. And so sugar, whether it be starch or, you know, one of its forms such as glucose or sucrose, right? Plants will store that over winter and they put it into different parts of their conductive tissue, their xylem and their phloem, to act as a natural antifreeze. so that their cells don't freeze and burst. And that's one of the reasons that maple syrup from maple trees in Canada tastes so good, is because it's more sugary, right? Because those trees need to produce more sugar and put it in their conductive tissues to overwinter. And if it's that process is really driven by the cues that it's very, very cold there. So in less cold climates where it's more favorable, they just don't need to invest in that overwintering strategy. And so there's just going to be less sugar in the sap.
So the sugar is almost created to kind of protect against the cold. So the yes. sugar is like protecting the trees, but it's also making it coincidentally sweeter for us to yes. enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Fun fact, man. That's so cool. Okay, two more and then we can be done. So, well, this one is very short, but botanically, a tomato is a berry and not a fruit.
Yeah. Yes. And a number of things that we call berries are not berries at all, like strawberries.
Right. So what's the deal with that? So the botanical names come from, how does that break down again?
Yeah. So the botanical names come from like the thickness of all their different fruit bearing structures, right? So fruits generally have three layers to them. And so when, like, for instance, watermelon, right? It has that hard outer shell. That is characteristic of a group of fruits known as pepos, right? Mm-hmm. They have that hard, thick outer shell, and then that soft, really moist, juicy texture on the inside that's super sugary. But berries are generally, right, they have this thing called a thin exocarp, right? It's really hard to peel the skin off of a tomato. It's super thin. Mm-hmm. And then the inside is super fleshy and juicy. And that's kind of how we characterize a berry, right? So it's kind of simple, but also pretty specific.
Yeah. And just so interesting that, like, I feel like there's always a like dialogue on, is a tomato a fruit? Is it a vegetable? You know what I mean? Like, what's it?
Right.
And it's actually not either of those. It's a berry.
Well, it's a fruit, but yes, it's a berry.
Right. Botanically a berry.
Right. Yeah.
And then another thing I thought was interesting is with the houseplant world, we have a lot of plants that flower through inflorescence. But well, mm-hmm. I know the word inflorescence because I know that all of my peperomia flower, quote unquote, in inflorescence, but I think of inflorescence as like the spike. So a peperomia's mm-hmm. flower doesn't have like a traditional quote unquote flower. It has an inflorescence, which is really just like a spike that sticks out in the air. And it's kind of like gray, or like, it's not particularly pretty. Maybe it's white. And then it just like dies back. Mm-hmm. But actually an inflorescence by definition is a cluster of flowers.
Yeah. So it's any plant that produces more than one flower per stem.
Right.
So yeah. So
my peperomia inflorescence quote is that spike that I see actually has like many different little flowers on it. Is that how that works?
I think so. I'm trying to see, look it up and see exactly what it looks like. If it's a true spike or, yeah, I think it is a true spike.
So if it's a true spike, then is it a flower?
Yes. So the spike, it's an inflorescence where it's like the spathe and the spadix kind of, right? So we have this spike that comes up and it can have lots of small flowers around the sides. So I looked at the peperonia flower and the best way I can describe it, it is a spike. It is an inflorescence. So on that individual spike that comes up, all those little ridges and bumps you see are actually the flowers. And they pretty much look fairly petalous, but if you look at them under the microscope, they look like little lemons sticking out of the side of the plant. They're like these little bulbous wart-like structures, and those are the individual flowers.
Okay, got it. But I thought that was interesting because I, with the small scope that I mm-hmm. have, which is just houseplants, like that's the word. I hear inflorescence and I just think that spike, but actually it could be a spike with several actual flowers on it. So I guess what would be an example of like a normal inflorescence, like in the normal sense? You know what I mean?
So like a very simple inflorescence would be like a rose, right? You get one flower per stem.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people don't realize is things like sunflower, all of our aster flowers are mm-hmm. actually composite flowers, right? That are made of two different types of flowers called disc flowers, which are the inside that ring in the center of the flower. Those are all microscopic flowers. Those are the ones actually doing the reproduction. And then what we think are petals are actually their own flowers that technically have a reproductive structure, but they're sterile, which means they can't engage in reproduction. And so the petals themselves, they're not just petals, they're their own flowers. and that right. the disc of the flower has their own petals.
That was wild. I can't believe I didn't even write that down because we just learned about it. But my mom grows 350 sunflowers every year in her front yard. And I have always looked at the sunflower head thinking that the seeds are in the middle and then the petals are on the side. And I've been looking at it incorrectly or thinking of it incorrectly for my entire life, which is so interesting because those yeah. seeds are in the middle of the head, but they come from a flower.
Yeah.
A million little flowers, not a million, but a lot.
Yes.
Okay. So Elle, you've been blowing my mind in our class for the last 7 weeks. You blew my mind again. I mean, I hope every listener walks away with a new fun fact from this conversation. Number one, Elle teaches a lot of classes at the New York Botanical Garden. I cannot recommend her teaching style enough and all of the different, you have several classes being offered currently, but where can we find you if we want to maybe follow what you're sharing on Instagram or take your classes, or where can we engage with you if we want to come nerd out with you?
Yeah. So I think one of the best places actually to connect with me and probably a great place to connect with other plant scientists is on Twitter, actually. There's a lot of us on Twitter. So yeah, so my handle's @EcoEvoL, right? So my name. And then of course, I have an Instagram, but it's just my own Instagram. There's nothing fun or scientific about okay. it. So I wouldn't follow me on there.
Okay. It feels like all of the scientists I've interviewed spend more time on Twitter. And then all of the like plant-based people I interview spend more time on Instagram. But Twitter seems to be where the scientists hang out.
Yeah, definitely. And there are so many scientists. I think people often think of scientists as like these people that just sit in a lab with a lab coat on and, mm-hmm. you know, don't associate. But there's a lot of us newer scientists that are a little bit more social. And we're always kind of online trying to convince more people to love science and see it in a new way and not think that it's such a difficult topic, but it's actually pretty easy for everyone to understand.
Yes,
so definitely check us out on Twitter.
Nail that. You are so good at that. So go check Elle out at EcoEvoL. Her link will be in the show notes. And make sure if you see the name Barnes at the end of any of the New York Botanical Garden classes that you go take her class because she is awesome. So thank you, Elle, so much. This was such a fun conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Wow, wow, wow. Thank you, Elle. Thank you, Dr. Barnes, for joining us and just for being a great teacher in that class. I really enjoyed learning from her, and I'm really excited to be taking her Science of Tree Communication this month as well. She is the best. Make sure to follow her at all the links in the show notes. Thank you again to our Patreon plant friends, and of course, thank you to Wally Grow. To get yourself Wally Grow's new planter, The Loop, or the Wally Grow Eco Planters that make up my green wall, head to wallygrow.com and use code BLOOMINGROW1515. So BLOOMINGROW15 for 15% off at checkout at wallygrow.com. And of course, thank you to the New York Botanical Garden for letting me take the class and interview Elle. If you are in the New York area, plant friends, I can't suggest enough that you become a member of the New York Botanical Garden. It is the most magical place with the most magical offerings. Walking around there just outdoors is incredible. And then you've got the conservatory and everything else they have to offer. It's an amazing place. So go to nybg.org to become a member. And don't forget to check out their virtual hub, nybg.org/nybg-at-home. Okay, plant friends, I hope you have beautifully planty weeks, that you are experiencing growth and blooms and advancement in your life. And until next time, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you are subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're making sure you're subscribed, why don't you head on over to the review section of whatever podcast player you're tuning into and leave us a review. I would greatly appreciate it. If you are interested in more fun and educational planty content, well, plant friend, I've got a whole lot for you. Subscribe to the Bloom and Grow YouTube show, which is my YouTube channel where I bring you along for my personal plant journey, as well as share informational content that pairs with our podcast episodes. Follow me at Bloom and Grow Radio on Instagram for behind the scenes sneak peeks at upcoming episodes, my daily planty lessons and thoughts, and most importantly, tune into my Instagram stories where I am constantly talking with you listeners and plant friends and polling you for content ideas, and I'm always interested in seeing what you're loving these days on Instagram. Join the Bloom and Grow mailing list and get a free download of the Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print that she created exclusively for our community. And if you can, support Bloom and Grow Radio by becoming a plant friend on Patreon. For as little as $4 a month, you not only help me bring these planty and informative episodes to thousands of ears around the world, but you will also get the super secret planty password to our exclusive Bloom and Grow Radio Garden Club Facebook group, which is a wonderfully active group of plant friends of the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast who make up what I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. It is a lot of fun over there. And as always, my sweet plant friends, I am here for you. If you have ideas for episode topics, guests, or if you're possibly a business interested in sponsoring the show, reach out to me because I am here to help all of you keep blooming and keep growing. Make new plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because Plant Friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible, so I made this cutie little Plant Parent Personality Quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about five key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.